From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1992 when you were reading poetry. Well, at least there was a better chance you were reading some poetry. The Survey of Public Participation in the Arts found that in 1992, 17% of Americans read at least one work of poetry in the past year. That number has fallen all the way to 6.7% according to the same survey. The Washington Post is kind of blunt about it. The Washington Post puts it this way. Poetry is less popular than jazz, less popular than dance, and only about half as popular as knitting. The only major arts category with a narrower audience than poetry is opera. Well, this is National Poetry Month, and despite the decline in readership, poetry is not at all dead yet. Don't believe the hype. Some of the most decorated writers and poets will point to poetry as a vital means to express themselves, to give voice to ideas, and to people who might not often be heard. And you're going to hear this hour a discussion of the value of teaching poetry more often. Let's think about our kids in school. Public schools are teaching poetry less often, but sometimes teaching poetry is not just about poetry. It's about skills that really translate elsewhere. So we've got a wonderful and decorated panel this hour, and let's welcome them here. Peter Connors is back, publisher for BOA Editions. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Chen Chen is here, author of When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities, published by BOA Editions last year, already pinned with numerous awards. And Chen has recently moved to Rochester as of just December. So yes. Honored to have you here. Thank you. Welcome to the program.
Really glad to be here.
And on the line with us is Christine Catano, who is the author of Sky Country, also published by BOA Editions last year, and assistant professor in the Department of Writing at Ithaca College. Christine, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
I want to start with just, you know, Peter and I were talking before the program began about just the reality of the numbers, and I say that as someone with a real appreciation for poetry and a love for poetry. The numbers can be a little bit tough. Does that make life tough in the publishing world, and how do you see those numbers moving back in a different direction?
You know, it's really interesting to hear them, and I'd never been nostalgic for 1992 before, but you just made me a little nostalgic for it. But, you know, what I'm really seeing at BOA is people feeling more passionate about poetry than ever, and perhaps, you know, we're not reaching outside of our poetry community as much as we'd like. That is something that we always try to do. But I know for the people who are reading poetry, for whom poetry means a lot, they seem to be clinging to it in these tumultuous times more than ever, and reaching for poetry. So quite frankly, our book sales have never been better, and we're seeing people really just embracing the art form.
Tomorrow you've got an event in the city of Rochester. Why don't you tell our listeners what's happening tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow, for those who don't know, is officially BOA Editions Day in Rochester by the mayor's proclamation. So we're really excited about that. We've been around for 41 years publishing poetry in Rochester, and it's great to have that sort of recognition. So we're going to have an event at the City Hall Atrium at 30 Church Street. Chen is going to be there reading his poems. The city is going to give the proclamation for BOA Editions Day. It's free and open to the public. It's going to start at 5:30. We're going to have some Eastman School musicians playing you in, and then the speakers will begin at 6. So from 5:30, we'll probably wrap up around 7:30, and we would love to have people out to hear Chen and celebrate BOA Editions Day.
All right, that is tomorrow. Now, this hour, we're going to have a chance to hear from Chen. I've asked him to read a little bit from some of his own work, and he said he's happy to do that. I would ask Christine to do that if she wants to. I mean, I certainly always defer to the artist if they're comfortable with that. But before we get there, I want to tackle an important question that comes up with the value of poetry, and I want to quote from The Atlantic Monthly. This is Andrew Simmons in a piece titled Why Teaching Poetry is So Important. Writes the following, quote, "Poetry enables teachers to teach their students how to write, read, and understand any text. Poetry can give students a healthy outlet for surging emotions. Reading original poetry aloud in class can foster trust and empathy in the classroom community, while also emphasizing speaking and listening skills that are often neglected in high school literature classes. Students who don't like writing essays may like poetry, with its dearth of fixed rules and its kinship with rap. For these students, poetry can become a gateway to other forms of writing. It can help teach skills that come in handy with other kinds of writing, like precise, economical diction, for example. When Carl Sandburg writes, "The fog comes on little cat feet," in just 6 words, he endows a natural phenomenon with character, a pace, and a spirit. All forms of writing benefit from the powerful and concise phrases found in poems. End quote. Christine, as someone who both writes and teaches, I would love to hear how you feel about that.
I love that. I love the idea that poetry has a very practical use in the classroom. And I think it does. It does teach students how to read and write in ways that maybe they're not taught in other types of classes. But beyond just that very straightforward practical aspect, what I always want to talk about in a poetry class is the complexity of emotion that is expressed in a poem. And I think that's something we don't get to encounter that much anymore. And it's what happens in art, it's what happens in music, and it's what happens especially in a poem, is that you can create or you can experience emotions that are not straightforward and are not simple. You never actually feel just happy or sad, but emotion is always much more nuanced than that. And in a poetry class, we have an opportunity to talk about that. And I think that's a space that doesn't always easily open up in other types of classes.
Chen, how do you feel about the passage you just heard?
Yeah, I also really love that idea as poetry as a gateway to other kinds of reading and writing, or as just foundational, because what it makes me think about is what can happen when you value delight and pleasure and surprise in language, and sort of the physical aspect of, you know, sounds and music. And when you can get students excited about that, I've found that, you know, they're more excited to engage with other texts or to engage with their own writing and rewriting in a way that isn't so just sort of locked into a cerebral, you know, relationship to language. I also think that, you know, social media has done so much to sort of change how we're thinking about reading and how we're thinking about the power of poetry. I mean, you think of how a poem can go viral, like Maggie Smith's Good Bones, and just shared so many times. So there's also that portability to a poem where, yeah, you can pull it up on your phone. And it's so encouraging to see people scrolling through, you know, their social media feed and actually looking at poems. You know, and not just advertisements or not just, you know, the news cycle, but allowing themselves that moment to encounter language in a very different way, and I think a much more humane way.
Certainly, if we are teaching less poetry in class, we will end up with fewer people writing poetry. I mean, that seems like almost like a tautology. But let me ask both of the poets on the panel, Chen and Christine, about your own recollections of growing up. Was it a singular teacher or professor who really turned you on to this form of expression? Did you find it yourself? Can you start taking me through what you can recall about that, Chen, and when you were really sort of exposed to reading and then writing your own poetry?
Yeah, I had some really wonderful English teachers in high school who were just extremely encouraging about me writing. I always had an interest in telling stories, and so I started out writing fiction rather than poetry. But as I started to read more of it on my own, and you know, one of my my sophomore English teacher recommended certain poets to me, like Li Yang Li, for example. I found others on my own, like Louise Glick, Robert Haas. And yeah, also just having a really wonderful local public library where I went to high school, and just having access to, you know, all these books and just checking them out and reading them in my own time. So yeah, it really started from there, but I really have to credit those teachers that I had.
Do you recall the first time you felt strongly that what you were writing is something that you wanted to pursue, maybe outside of classroom assignments?
I think pretty early on, I'd say in elementary school, I would write these, I guess, sort of skits or plays, and I'd get my group of friends to perform them with me. And so it was actually this sort of collaborative process, but I just loved that language could, you know, something could come alive, a whole world could be created from words. So I think, yeah, really just starting to play from an early age and immersing myself in stories, creating stories of my own. Yeah.
Christine, what about you? What's your recollection? How far back does it go when you were really taught poetry, appreciated, and can remember writing it?
I think, like Chen and like many people who eventually become poets, I did start out more as a fiction writer. I loved stories. I liked writing stories and reading stories when I was a kid. And then it was sometime in high school that I picked up a collection of poems by Gary Soto. I was living in California, and Gary Soto is a California poet, and he wrote about his experiences, and the collection was titled Junior College. And I think I was a sophomore or a junior in high school. I was thinking about what I was going to do next, and here was this person who was writing so clearly and eloquently about everything that I was feeling at the time. And I encountered it in poems in a way that I didn't encounter it in stories. And I think that was my first real exposure to poetry, and I thought, I really want to do this. I want to do something like this. I then went to college, and I continued taking fiction classes. I still had the sense that poetry was not for me in some way, even though I had read Gary Soto's work that moved me so much. I felt like poetry was still more formal, that it was older, that it was more stylized, that I wouldn't have as much freedom in a poem. But then I did take a beginning poetry class with Chris Buckley at UC Riverside, and he completely changed my worldview. He showed me what poems could do. He showed me free verse poems, mostly poems written by people who were recognizable to me, people who had lived in Southern California, who grew up in the landscape that I knew and wrote about that landscape. And I felt at that point that poetry was really something I could do. So it was early exposure to stories that I was always interested in, but it wasn't really until I got to college and had a teacher who took me by the hand and showed me that I could write this that I felt like I could be a poet.
There is, Christine Chen, Peter, there is this idea, I think, that is expressed in the Atlantic piece and expressed in a lot of places, that some of where poetry has struggled in public schools is the this caricature that we may have of a teacher saying, you will learn iambic pentameter, you know, you will learn the structure, and you know, we will beat you over the head with meter, and you will understand it, as opposed to under so a very technical but less of as an outlet for expression and emotion. And I guess when I want to say is a couple of things. Number one, I mean, it's obvious that great teachers matter. Great teachers matter in every subject. Dynamic teaching matters in across the board. It does not just apply to poetry or the arts. So that's obvious on its face. But I do want to ask if you think that caricature does exist and if that has hurt poetry. Christine?
I haven't encountered that. I've never encountered a professor who was adamant about teaching in a very specific way, either in a writing class or a literature class. I've been lucky, I guess, that all the poetry teachers I've encountered have been so open and dynamic and genuinely interested in teaching people why they love poetry. Every teacher I've had has loved poetry and has been able to, through that passion, reach their students. So I've been lucky in that way. I don't know if that character exists, only because I've never encountered it myself.
Okay. Good. Jen?
Yeah, for me, I haven't encountered teachers who really teach that way. What I have seen is, unfortunately, when there are the pressures and the expectations of standardized testing, and teachers having to teach to the test, basically. And so I think that constrains how a lot of teachers would really prefer to talk about poetry, in a more, freewheeling, conversational way that, is based on an emotional response and a response to the music of the poem, the pleasure of the poem. But instead they have to, cover, these technical aspects, and sometimes in very dry ways. So yeah, for me, it's not really, I haven't been in classes with teachers who, really seem to think like this is the way to teach poetry. But I think at times there is that pressure.
And Peter, I think Chen makes such an important point that when we think about standardized testing, and we think about the restrictions on teachers to begin with their time, and we've had a lot of conversations on this program about teachers trying to simply maneuver in public school spaces to be creative within these strictures of standardized testing. You can start to see where they might say, well, poetry, we don't have time for poetry, and there's a real risk there. What do you make of that?
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm also a parent raising children who are in public schools, and I see the struggle that teachers have to integrate arts into schools and the way it can be left behind. And, you know, the truth is that BOA, not only do we put our books out into the world, but we send these amazing ambassadors for poetry out into the world, all of our poets. And one thing I will say, just on Saturday, I brought my 10-year-old daughter to a poetry reading. And she, one of her first comments was, "Is he rapping?" And then we sort of talked about, you know, how poetry is delivered and so forth. And I see time and time again, people who are not familiar with poetry or maybe intimidated by poetry, go to an actual poetry reading and leave with a completely different conception of what poetry is. So I'd say, you know, not just to parents, but also to parents, bring your kids to a poetry reading. And if you're maybe a little confused about poetry, give it a shot by actually going to a reading, because to hear the delivery from the poet is absolutely revelatory. And that's one of the things that I love about BOA, is just sending all these wonderful poetry ambassadors out into the world. And quite frankly, BOA also donates a lot of books to schools and to libraries and so forth every year. We donate hundreds of books. So we're doing all we can to put poetry out into the general conversation.
All right, let me get a phone call. And listeners, if you want to join the conversation about poetry this hour, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Wendy in Rochester wants to weigh in on exactly what we're talking about right now. Go ahead, Wendy.
Hi. Yeah, when Common Core came in and I read my first Common Core test, I gave the test on poetry to local poets, and every one of them disagreed with the state's answers. And I went and did a presentation where I made a modest proposal that poetry should be banned in the schools. And my reasoning is this: if you ban it, teenagers will discover it and think they invented it. And they won't come at it as something dry and that they're going to be tested on. Who would learn to drive if all you were allowed to do when you were learning to drive was go do errands for other people and be graded on how you did them? That's basically how poetry is being used. So I think anybody who doesn't love a poem should not teach it.
Wendy, can you stay there for a second? This is an interesting point, because this dovetails with an encore conversation we played for you earlier this week with Sarah Holbrook, a poet who wrote a piece on a number of platforms explaining how her work ended up on a standardized test, and she could not successfully answer the questions about her own poetry. And so that, I think, dovetails with what Wendy is saying here, and then how do we get there, and who should be writing those questions? But Wendy, what worries me is if we say, you know, if we want to be restrictive, and I understand why you feel that way, but isn't that inevitably going to lead to less and less poetry in sort of the public consumption by kids at public schools? Isn't that also a risk?
Well, I'm being tongue-in-cheek about banning it, but okay. I would definitely take it off all the tests, because basically the only reason they're using it on the test is because it is a short, concentrated piece of literature that they can fit into the time frame of a test.
Very interesting.
And,
yeah. No,
and they're not using poetry. They're not allowing kids to discover a love for poetry. Kids are being punished for not understanding it. And if you're afraid you're not going to understand something, you're not going to open a book of it. And I love not understanding poetry, because then I read it again and again until I get something else out of it. The idea that you can approach something as something that you might never understand and could still love, that's missing.
Mm. Wendy, thank you. Really interesting ideas there. And let me turn to Christine Catano, who is the author of Sky Country, published by BOA Editions last year, and assistant professor in the Department of Writing at Ithaca College. I'll turn to Christine first on that. Can you successfully write test questions for poetry, Christine?
It's not easy to do. I do give tests in my literature courses, but it's really about making sure that they understand how a poem is put together. They are generally more open-ended questions, certainly not the type of test that you could fit into a Scantron type of exam.
Chen, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about that word discovery and how important that is for approaching poetry. And with my own students, you know, I'll always say, you know, these are texts that, you know, I've selected and, you know, I enjoy or find provocative and want to talk about. But that doesn't mean that you're going to love, you know, every single one of them. There's so many different kinds of poetry. So I always just try to emphasize that and have students also bring in poems that they found or, you know, pieces of language. It doesn't have to necessarily be a poem. Sometimes it can be a quote, you know, from a movie or something. But just to get us engaged with language in that really close, intimate, vulnerable way. So I try to, de-emphasize this idea that there is, you know, a right answer and that, you know, there's just this perfect poem that has to be puzzled out.
Sure. And the idea, Peter, is that if you have test questions with a yes or no or a right or wrong, a multiple choice, that there is some sort of an objective truth that can be sussed out. And what I'm hearing from the poets on is that that's hard. You know, that's very difficult to do that. And we're putting a lot of weight on something that is a lot more nebulous than just either right or wrong or yes or no. And even poets themselves, like Sarah Holbrook, have said, I'm not even sure, you know, you gave four answers for what was the author trying to say here, and none of them were what I was trying to say. You know, and in those moments, I wonder how you feel if your 10-year-old has test questions on poetry. As someone who's a BOA publisher, does that drive you nuts, or do you think at least they're trying?
Well, you know, I think in general it's an interesting thing because we have to take a look at what we're actually teaching kids, like what's the goal of our educational system. And the truth is that poetry is asking people to think creatively. It's asking them to think independently and to think critically, but in a way that's sort of outside of the box, as we say. And I'm not quite sure that our educational system in general is really set up for that. You know, that's a really unique way to teach and to look at education as a whole. So in a way, you know, I think poetry sort of falls outside of this rubric of the way our educational systems are set up in general. But the great teachers will figure out a way to integrate poetry into things that aren't just English class. You know, there's no reason why poetry can't be used to teach about the Civil War. You know, Walt Whitman is a fantastic poet to bring into that conversation. And, you know, there's poets for every era that can really illuminate different parts of a discussion that have nothing to do with English class. So I would really encourage schools and teachers and so forth to look for different ways that you can use poetry outside of just English.
All right, let me grab Richard and Kendall next on the phone. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to actually tell a little story, but I am a retired media and English teacher from the city school district from Edison Tech. And one of the things I noticed, because obviously most of my kids are inner city kids, they consumed a lot of rap and hip hop. And they were very, very open about creating their own rap and hip-hop, whether it be in Media Shop or whether it was in my English class. And I found that pretty enlightening and also fairly easy in terms of getting kids to view poetry as something that was part of their lives. But at any rate, I wanted to talk about very briefly an experience I had about 20 years ago. I went to a poetry workshop in New England, which was being run by Andre Kudrescu, and some you may know about his work. He has, or has had in the past, an organization that deals with surrealist poetry. And Andre was running this poetry workshop and doing all sorts of different kinds of exercises, some of which I took back to school and used. But the interesting part of it was, the evening I arrived, this Friday night I arrived at this workshop, was the night that Jerzy Kosinski was found in his bathtub with a plastic bag over his head. I'm sorry to be maudlin about this, but at any rate, he had committed suicide that very day. And unbeknownst to myself, Andrei Kudrescu and Jerzy Kosinski were very close friends. They were both from Eastern Europe, had suffered through childhoods during the Nazi occupations. And when I went to meet Andre, when we were reintroducing ourselves around the room, I happened to mention to him that I just heard on the radio that Jerzy Kosinski was just found dead. And Andre had not heard about it. And so for the rest of the weekend, He couldn't meet my glance, my eyes. I was a persona non grata in that workshop. It was a strange and interesting experience, but what I came away with was a lot of interesting techniques to get kids thinking in terms of rhythm, poetry, using words in a creative manner. And I did ultimately get a lot out of that workshop and used it in both my media shop and in my English classes.
Well, Richard, thanks for that. That makes me want to ask our guests, if you have teachers who come to you, and I'll start with you, Chen, if you've got teachers who come to you and say, help me teach poetry better, you know, obviously, that's a big, broad question because we don't even know what their approach may be to begin with. But generally speaking, what are some things that you would share with teachers who truly, sincerely want to do a better job of teaching poetry?
Well, I'm thinking about, I mean, part of the beauty of a poem, I think, is how much it asks us to slow down and to pay attention in a different way. So often I'll see folks trying to teach poetry and cover, you know, a whole lot of ground. And again, that might be because they're teaching to a test of a certain kind. But I love having the opportunity to really slow down the teaching as well. You know, spend a whole class session just talking about one poem, and just talking about every aspect of that poem, and getting, you know, a range of different interpretations about what's going on in that poem. Because I think that that's what, you know, the best poems are really asking us to do, to really slow our attention, to engage with language, you know, really closely and also playfully, imaginatively, you know, to look at an image, you know, for longer than 5 seconds and, you know, just move on from it after, you know, you've come to a certain conclusion about it. But to look and look again. So that's the main thing that I recommend, to really slow down.
And Christine, if you have, especially, you know, say high school English teachers who come to you and say, I want to be a better teacher of poetry, where do I start?
I think my first suggestion would be for them to find a poem that they themselves love. It's hard to teach a poem that you don't feel emotionally connected to, but there are so many poems out there. And if you keep reading and you keep looking, I think everyone can find a poem that just gives them that immediate experience of being in touch with the poem. So I would suggest that they work towards finding a poem that they feel comfortable with, and hopefully they can pass on that experience to the students. And the other thing is to be okay with not fully understanding how a poem works. A lot of times you can read a poem and you can have an emotional reaction, and it's difficult to trace exactly how you arrive at that reaction. And there are some parts of a poem that will always remain mysterious. And as a teacher, it can be hard to admit that to your students, that you're not exactly sure how the poem made this emotion happen. But I think being open about the mystery of the poem is a way to open up the experience to the students and say you can love a poem even if you don't fully understand everything and how it's working.
Well, we're late for our only break. Here's what we want to do here. When we come back from this break, we're going to ask Chen and Christine to tell us about their works. Chen is the author of When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities, published by BOA Editions last year. Christine, the author of Sky Country, also published by BOA. We'll talk about, I want to hear from Peter Connors on this, your thoughts on these remarkable works and the impact you think they've had on the BOA stable of work. And we'll hear from the authors on that. And I also want, before we go to break, I'd like to ask Peter Connors to tell you once again what's happening tomorrow that you should know about. Go ahead, Peter.
So tomorrow we're having a reading with Chen Chen at the City Hall Atrium at 30 Church Street. It's going to start at 5:30. It's free and open to the public, and it is for Chen's being here in Rochester. It is for National Poetry Month, and it is to celebrate BOA Editions Day, which is tomorrow.
That is tomorrow, BOA Editions Day, and a chance. The doors open tomorrow at 5:30. Is that right?
Program
starts at 6 o'clock, free and open to the public. Let's get that break, and we'll come right back talking poetry on Connections next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. Is the age of Trump the age of American greatness, or is it an age of American psychosis? A public intellectual who is a guest at the University of Rochester's Humanities Center argues the latter. We'll talk to him about it. Then, in our second hour, we get ready for inductions to the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. We welcome Steve Gadd, among others. Talk with you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. Chen Chen is the author of When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities. And Peter Connors, publisher for BOA Editions. Tell us about the relationship with Chen and when you were first aware of Chen's work, your thoughts on the work, and then we'll talk to the author about the work.
Chen was actually winner of our A. Poulin Jr. Poetry Prize contest, and that is a contest that we have every year, and it's for people who haven't yet published a book of poetry. And I think when you hear Chen read his poems, you might be amazed that this is his first book, but it is. And so he actually submitted through this contest. We had an outside judge, as we do every year. The next judge is Patricia Smith for the next contest. The judge who selected Chen's manuscript ultimately was Jericho Brown. It's important to know that there was probably about 700 different submissions in that cycle, so Chen's rose to the top of that. And Jericho writes a wonderful introduction to the book as well. And what he says is, this is a stunning debut and the first of what is bound to be several beautifully necessary books. And I couldn't agree more. I think it's a remarkable debut. And, you know, the book has gone on to get all sorts of acclaim. It won the GLCA New Writers Award. It was long listed for the National Book Award. Currently, it's a finalist, and we're waiting to hear for the Tom Gunn Prize for Gay Poetry and also the Lambda Literary Award. So it's gotten all sorts of acclaim, which helps us go like, yeah, we were onto something with this one for sure.
Just reading the reviews, I'm just going to choose one of them, Chen, and then I want to ask you as the author if you feel like they're capturing the sense that you wanted to provide as the writer. This is from Publishers Weekly. They say, Chen balances the politics surrounding shame and desire with hearty doses of joy, humor, and whimsy in his vibrant debut collection. To consider the titular act of growing up, to recognize what potential could mean, Chen must make sense of his past to imagine a better future in his poems. As a gay Asian American poet, Chen casts his poems as both a refusal of the shame of sexuality and of centering whiteness or treating it as a highly desirable trait. Readers encounter sharp, delightful turns between poems as Chen shifts from elegy to ode and back again. Moving between whimsy and sobriety, Chen both exhibits and defies vulnerability, an acute reminder that there are countless further possibilities. How's that sit with you?
That sounds great. I mean, I don't know if I could describe it better.
Okay,
myself.
So that's Publishers Weekly, but I could have picked any of several dozen reviews of that sense. So let me start by asking you if you wanted to leave your readers with your story, if you wanted to tell sort of more timeless or broader stories, you know, what was goal number one for you, if there was one?
I think one of the main goals in writing this collection or putting it together was to really reimagine what some of these identity categories could mean. So, you know, like immigrant or Chinese American, Asian American, gay or queer, male, like all these categories of identity, of experience, and to really show how each of these can be a lot more complicated, a lot more expansive than at first glance. And so that's, you know, what I mean when with this title of When I Grow Up. This idea that there's a perpetual growing up, that, you know, it isn't just this one stage in one's life. And so, yeah, I really wanted to bring that sense of potential, you know, as the review is saying, and discovery and continually opening up to different experiences and different ways of sort of expressing, articulating, naming who you are in relation to others and to the world.
Do you write first for yourself or for an audience?
That's a great question. I think it depends on the poem. I think there are ones that feel or start off feeling more private to me. And I'm not even sure if it's a piece that I'm going to share with someone else. But I always try to give myself that permission because I think that often if the writing is making me sort of uncomfortable or nervous or scared even, that's a good indicator of, oh, I am, you know, really hitting upon something here. This is something I need to grapple with further. So yeah, I'll give myself that permission to just write it down, just get it down on paper, and then, yeah, other considerations about audience or how I might share it will come.
Do you want to choose one or two to read?
Yeah, sure. So this first poem is called Self-Portrait With and Without. With dried cranberries, without a driver's license, with my mother's mother's worry, without, till recently, my father's glasses, with an A in English, a C in chemistry, with my mother saying, you have to be 3 times better than the white kids at everything, without a dog or cat, with a fish I talk to before bed, telling him my ideas for new kinds of candy, with a tutor in Mandarin, with the 1986 low-budget live-action TV version of Journey to the West, with Monkey King's quest for redemption, Buddhism through Monster of the Week battle sequences, with thinking, I've grown up now, because I regularly check the news in the morning. With the morning the children, spared or missed by the child with a gun, go back to school, make the same jokes they made 3 Mondays ago, but in a different voice. With the younger brother who is taller than I am, with the youngest brother who wants to go to art school, with my mother's multiplying worries, with my brothers, with the cry of bats, with the salt of circumstance, without citizenship, with the white boy in 9th grade who called me ugly, without my father for a year because he had to move away to the one job he could find on the other side of the state, with his money transferred to my mother, with William Carlos Williams, with the local library, with yet another bake sale for Honduras in Massachusetts suburbia, with the earthquake in my other country, with my mother's long-distance calls, with my aunt's calls from China when the towers fell. How far are you from New York? How far are you from New York? With cities fueled by scars, with the footprint of a star, with the white boy I liked, with him calling me ugly, with my knees on the floor, with my hands begging for straighter teeth, lighter skin, blue eyes, green eyes, any eyes brighter other than mine. And I'll just read one other short poem. This is called Summer Was Forever. Time dripped from the faucet like a magician's botched trick. I did not want to applaud it. I stood to one side and thought, what's time for is a garden or a croissant factory. What kind of work do I need to be doing? My parents said, doctor, married to lawyer. The faucet said, drip, drop, your life sucks. But sometimes no one said anything, and I saw him, the local paperboy on his route, his beanstalk frame and fragile bicycle, and I knew we would be so terribly happy. Our work would be simple. Our kissing would rhyme with cardiac arrest. Birds would overthrow the cathedral towers. I would have a magician's hair full of sleeves and saws, unashamed to tell the whole town our first date was in a leaky faucet factory. How we fell in love during jumps on his tragic uncle's trampoline. We fell in love in midair. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing those. Can I ask you to tell us a little bit? In some ways, this is always a hard interview moment to do because, you know, do you want your audience to react? Do you want to expound a little more on the poems themselves? How do you feel? What do you
I
want
can talk
the audience
a little
to?
Bit.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that first poem that I read, Self-Portrait With and Without, I was really fascinated with the self-portrait form. Actually, especially after reading this book by Araceli Scrimai, who's also a poet. Her book, Kingdom Animalia, which has several self-portraits in it. It was just a form that I hadn't really encountered much before, but then I started reading more of them, like in Eduardo C. Corral's book, Slow Lightning as well. And I became sort of obsessed with this idea because I was struggling for a while to kind of bring in autobiographical material into a poem and make it surprising just for myself and then hopefully for a reader as well. But the self-portrait form got me thinking about, you know, this idea of like what is the subject posing with? And then this idea that the subject could be posing with an absence as well, the without, that something that's being left out or discarded or lost could also figure in the poem. So that was what I really wanted to explore in that poem, that you know the self and in particular this child of immigrant self is constructed from you know, the things that are present as much as the things that are absent as much as the things that are present. So yeah, that's what I was thinking with that poem. With the second one, Summer Was Forever, I was thinking about sonnets, because that poem's in a sort of pseudo-sonnet form. It's in 14 lines. There's sort of this progression that's similar to, I guess, a Shakespearean sonnet. But I was interested in bringing that form into a very contemporary context and using language that, you know, you might not expect from a sonnet, so that it really doesn't appear to be that, you know, that form on first glance. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Thank you for doing that, and thank you for sharing those poems and telling us your thoughts behind them. We're talking to Chen Chen, the author of When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities. It might occur to our listeners they'd like to know where, Peter Connors, they can get BOA Editions works like this. Where can they?
So we have a website, boaeditions.org. We have a great bookstore there, or you can get them anywhere books are sold. And I should say that for Chen's reading tomorrow, we will have books for sale at the event. So if you would like to get a copy of Chen's book there, we'll be selling them. And also we'll have some time at the end for Chen to sign the book and chat with you a little bit about it.
Christine Catano is on the line with us, and she's the author of Sky Country, also published by BOA Editions. Christine, why don't you tell us, in this particular book, some of the backstory, the family backstory that helps underpin some of the work here.
Sure. So when I was working on this collection, I knew I wanted to tell the stories of my two grandmothers, one who immigrated from Korea after the war and started her life here, and my other grandmother who immigrated from Japan before World War II and started her life in the United States, and then after the bombing of Pearl Harbor was incarcerated in concentration camps. And these are both stories that I had heard growing up, but I knew that I wanted to figure out how to transform this personal history into poems in this book.
There are a number that would stand out to me, but I'll ask you in the same way. If you want to choose one or two, do you have the material in front of you? Are you able to do that?
Yes, I can do that.
Okay.
So I'll read the first poem about my grandmother who immigrated from Korea. So this is titled Chicken Soup. My grandmother pours salt into my right palm, places thin slivers of garlic in my left. She explains something about blood, how to salt the raw bird to drain its fluids, but my mind already wanders. I watch the chicken shrivel but compose instead the grandfather I've only met in story. Daybreak, he's just finished mopping up in the buildings that sculpt this city skyline, but it's someone else's view of Los Angeles. The immigrant sees not the postcard-perfect lights, but the scuffed tiles, dust-lined desks, the darkening throats of toilet after toilet. Home, he tiptoes upstairs not to wake his daughters, holding his shoes like a thief. He's fired for stealing a roll of toilet paper, a can of soda for my mother. Children are nothing but trouble, my grandmother says, shaking a wooden spoon. My mother claims the story otherwise. It was she who accompanied father to work, she who stole a box of stale donuts, she who lost the family's first job. Grandmother shrugs and repeats the same conclusion. Never have children, she says, though her expression is hidden by the steam now rising from the pot. It's a simple recipe. Boil until the meat falls from the bones, easy like a girl shedding a summer dress. Last night I cooked for friends. After dinner, my friend handed me his one-month son, who only blinked when I nudged my thumb into his fist. Earlier, washing the pale bird, I struggled to keep the body from slipping through my hands. I held its small fleshed form under cold water, pulled the giblets out the round hollow between its ribs, and was surprised to be surprised when it didn't make a sound.
Can I ask you to share a little bit more about the expression you're trying to offer in Chicken Soup?
I was thinking about my relationship to my family history, and so much of it is clouded because my grandmother doesn't speak much English and I don't speak much Korean, and so I feel like all my life, everything she said to me, my version of what she says to me has always been an interpretation, and that was it was that sense of distance and trying to close that distance that I wanted to express in this poem. What is it like to have stories but not have full access to those stories? And that was what I was interested in this poem.
Hmm. Remarkable. Is there another that you can share with us?
Sure. I'll share a short poem. This is a poem that is about my father who was 16 when he was incarcerated in the Japanese American concentration camps. And again, I was thinking about my relationship to that personal history. So it's titled, 1942, in response to Executive Order 9066, my father, 16, takes no spare underwear, no clean shirts, pants, or good shoes. Instead, a suitcase of records, his trombone. This is not the whole story, and yet it is true. It is a story without an ending. And when I open my mouth to speak, it continues.
Hmm. There's a poem in the book called "I Will Explain Hope" that I found devastating. And there just I don't know how else to say this, Christine. I mean, this is not my skill as a reader or an interviewer. This is not my expertise. But I think you do a remarkable job at bringing us there to a place and to a place of pain and suffering and, frankly, shame. And so tell me a little bit about what you just read, and then I'll ask you another question to follow up on that subject. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what you just read?
Well, in the poem I just read, again, I was thinking about what role I have to tell these stories. And every time you tell a story, it's an interpretation and a reinterpretation. And at first, I was very uncomfortable with that. I felt like I was changing stories, that I was making things up. But as I continued to work, I realized that that's my role. My role is to reinterpret these stories, to tell them as I know them. And I felt like that's what I wanted to do as a poet. I wanted to take these stories that otherwise would just remain in the past and remain history and to bring them into the present moment.
In the poem, I Will Explain Hope, which I will not read in its entirety, but you know, just listeners, think of how devastating the poem starts with, I will explain hope, but not today. And you conclude with a line that I found surprising, and if you don't mind, I'd just like to ask you about it. Because you're talking about a really shameful chapter in our country's history that had an intimate impact on your own family. And you conclude with this line, what choice but to forgive such a brave failure? You surprised me with that line. Can you tell me a little bit about what you meant there?
When I was working on the poems told in a persona who is incarcerated, one of the things I wanted to avoid was portraying her as a victim or just purely as a victim. I wanted to find a much more complex and nuanced view of this. And I was doing some research and looking at the first generation of Japanese American immigrants to be put in these concentration camps. There was something almost forgiving is maybe not even the right word, but there was an understanding that they were in a circumstance and it was unfair, but what could they do about it? They had to continue on in some way. And it wasn't necessarily a forgiveness of the fact, but a forgiveness of the mistake. It was a very complex feeling, and I think that a poem is possibly capable of expressing the complexity of that, and that was what I was trying to do, and I Will Explain Hope. I was trying to move past just the victimization and look at what are the different ways that we can approach this subject matter.
We open the hour by taking a look at how few Americans have read at least one work of poetry in the past year, less than 7% by the latest numbers, and what that means to us. And I think that what we've heard this hour from authors Chen Chen, Christine Kitano, is that we're missing something if we don't have that as a conduit to understanding experience, to feeling, to learning about that. And Christine's book is Sky Country. It's available from BOA Editions now. Chen Shen's book is When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities, also available now. And I want to thank them for taking the time to not only be on the program, but to share with our listeners some of their poetry and to kind of peel back the curtain a little bit and take us inside that. Christine, thank you. I look forward to reading more, and I really appreciate you taking the time for the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chen Shen, great having you here. And I know there's an event tomorrow, so a chance for our listeners to meet you there. But continued success here in Rochester. Thanks again for taking the time to come here.
Yeah, thanks so much for the conversation.
Peter Connors, publisher for BOA Editions. Tomorrow, one more time for the listeners, what's happening tomorrow?
There's going to be a poetry reading for for BOA Editions Day here in Rochester. It's going to be at the City Hall Atrium at 30 Church Street. It is free and open to the public, and it starts at 5:30 p.m.
5:30 p.m. tomorrow, free, City Hall. Enjoy that. Peter, thank you. Thanks for organizing this conversation and keeping our focus on this subject. I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Our thanks to Barsuk Records for the music for this program. That's Ra Ra Riot with some local ties. We always appreciate that. And thank you for listening. We're back with you Friday on member-supported public radio.